So I thought I'm thinking that we're still continuing the introductory course that ended 2 weeks ago, and the sessions kind of after introductory course, I kind of like to continue on topics that somehow build on what we talked about. And so I have kind of two ideas of what to do this evening. One is to give a talk about walking meditation, because it's a very important part of kind of the practice we do. And the other alternative would be to take this time just to answer questions. You've heard me speak a lot the last few weeks, and last week you had a guest, and it might be nice to give you a chance to ask all your questions about the practice. So what would you like? A talk or questions? I heard more talk.
Questions.
Little of each. Okay, I'll try to do that. It might be useful to distinguish between two aspects of the mind. One is what we can call the activity of the mind, and the other is the mind's ability to be aware of what's going on, to be aware. And the two aren't, you know, separate from each other, because when many of the activities of mind, we can be aware of the activities happening while they're happening. But activities of mind means many things. It means everything that the mind does. But one of the things that the mind does is it, often enough, is it chases after discursive thought. It chases after ideas and concepts. And there's a way in which we can get ourselves wrapped up and preoccupied with particular thoughts, ideas, memories, plans in the future, whatever. And that particular planning of tomorrow, that particular memory of yesterday, that particular fantasy or that particular concern or whatever, begins to be the place that the thoughts kind of chase each other or get pull each other. I don't know exactly what they do. But off you go down this particular thought train. And there's all this mental activity around of thinking around some particular concern or many concerns. Some days it's just scattered. It's all over the place. And many of us live much of our life in our discursive thinking. And many of us, for many people, it's never occurred to them to live anywhere else. We grow up, and some point growing up, we learn how to speak, and we learn how to think, and we learn how to think with concepts. And I don't know when it happens, and we're about a year and a half or 2 years, and then we're off and running, and forevermore, in our thoughts and our ideas. And the idea that there's any alternative is just a completely foreign idea to some people. But one of the alternatives is, if you follow me with this distinction, is the mind's ability to know, to be aware. And knowing and the activity of the mind are, I'm saying, are two different things. Because, for example, you can be involved in some kind of discursive thinking, and there can be this very direct and clear awareness or knowing that I'm thinking. What we try to do in mindfulness is to try to strengthen this capacity, very simple capacity, to rest in the knowing. Not so much we're trying to know more things, like chasing after more knowledge, but rather to rest in the mind's ability to simply be aware, as an alternative to kind of being running around in discursive thoughts. The image of discursive thoughts is that of a I had some years ago. Is we had a little in the house I lived with, a little kitten, and at some point the kitten discovered its tail. And it was constantly running around trying to catch its tail, and it could never reach it. So kind of maybe thoughts are like that. We're racing around after them, but we can never get to them. And we get very stressed out, I think, with all the discursive thinking that we get kind of lost in and consumed by. And the more busy we get, ironically, the more busy we get with discursive thinking, the more our preoccupations, concerns are, the faster our life can often get, and often less aware we are that we're lost in discursive thinking. There's a way in which all the discursive thoughts create a kind of veil over our ability to see clearly. And we don't see. We don't know what's actually going on. We kind of get lost so easily in this world. So to find some way to rest in just the ability to be aware, is actually a very powerful way of living. And it's a kind of an alternative to thinking. Not so much alternative to thinking, it's alternative to being possessed by our thoughts. It's interesting, many of us are so concerned with our thinking all the time that we have one thought and then we immediately kind of go to the next one, and immediately we're concerned about the next one, and immediately we're concerned about the next one. And we've never noticed that sometimes there's a gap between our thoughts. We don't necessarily think continuously all the time. There can be a moment where we're not thinking between the various thoughts. And who are we, and what's happening to us in that gap, in that moment between our thinking? And are we alive? Are we alive in a vital way? Are we? Is it a worthwhile place to be alive and vital in a place where we're not thinking? For some people, get very afraid when the mind is not thinking actively or in any kind of alternative place to be besides completely kind of preoccupied in our thoughts, because it's in our thoughts that we formulate a concept of who we are. The ideas we have of who we are, the ideas we have of how we have to be in relationship to everybody else in the world, belongs to the world of thinking and ideas. And if we're attached to being who we think we have to be, and there's some moments where our thoughts are not operating that usual way, it can be very frightening because we don't have that reference anymore. Who am I in that gap between our thoughts? Because in the gap between the thoughts, there's no idea, right, of who you can be, because there's no thoughts to have the idea with. Are you following me? Okay. So knowing is different than thinking. And the idea is, can we find some way to rest in that? And knowing is pervasive. It's really part of our life all the time. It's here all the time. It's not like this weird thing that we imported from Asia, from Asian Buddhism, so that, you know, to add to our life. You know, our knowingness, our ability to be aware, is here all the time. So a lot of what the mindfulness practice is learning how to strengthen this capacity to know, and finding that it's actually a wonderful alternative. It's a place where we can find some refuge, some peace, some rest, some sense of wholeness, some alternative to the kind of fragmented way we can feel when we're always in our thoughts and our preoccupations. So the 5 weeks of the introductory course was, in a sense, kind of trying to lay out the various ways in which knowing can happen, what we can be aware of. But the principle behind it all is this ability to know. And the beautiful thing about knowing is you can bring it to all of your life, including the most ordinary things about your life. And actually, a lot of where spiritual life is developed is in the ordinary activities of living, of being alive. Someone once said that a spiritual life is first of all a life. I like that saying. Because sometimes there's a tendency to think that a spiritual life is a life that's different than our ordinary life. That we have to do something, we have to be really special, we have to do something really different. We have to go to a monastery or go to Asia or go do this and that. But it's first of all our life as it is. And it has a lot to do with how, a spiritual life has a lot to do with how we live our life, not necessarily what we do with our life. And since most of us spend most of our time doing ordinary things, how we bring our practice, how we bring our knowingness, how we bring ourselves to the ordinary activities of our life becomes a very important aspect of Buddhist mindfulness practice. The how of what we do. So, for example, if we go about washing the dishes or driving to work, and we're like the kitten kind of chasing its tail in our thoughts, kind of preoccupied and worried about this and that and running around in our thoughts and what's going on, that's one how, that's one way of being. An alternative to that would be to wash the dishes and let the knowing rest in the washing the dishes, to really allow yourself to be there and allow yourself to just wash the dishes, to really wash the dishes, not to kind of get lost in their thoughts or be preoccupied or be lost, distracted. Or to drive to work and simply allow yourself to drive to work with the knowingness that you're driving to work in a very simple, matter-of-fact way. So there's presence, so there's kind of maybe some level of calm, some settledness in driving to work. I know that I can drive around completely unsettled. I can turn on the radio and listen to the news, and at the same time I can think about where I'm going. At the same time I can be upset about the traffic. At the same time I can be concerned about that sound my car's making. You know, all these thoughts and concerns, you know, that actually in some ways pull me out of the ability just to be right here in this activity as it's happening. So one of the aspects of Buddhist practice is learning to find some joy and some worthwhileness in actually, in some sense, being kind of simple in the ordinary activities we're always doing all the time. To find ourselves in doing the ordinary activities rather than doing the ordinary activities and actually being somewhere else because we're kind of lost in our discursive thoughts. One of the ordinary activities that many of us do is we walk. We do walking. The Buddha said there are four dignified postures for doing meditation practice in. The four dignified postures are sitting, walking, standing, and laying down. And that's kind of supposed to cover all of it, right? And so in all those activities, you can do the practice. And so walking is just one other way of doing it. And because we kind of put a lot of emphasis on sitting, I do, and I give the 5-week introductory course, and I might never mention anything about walking meditation. And to a great extent, by doing that, I do a great disservice to those who listen to me, who come for the introductory course, which I apologize for, because the implication or the sense or the idea that could be picked up is, oh, sitting meditation is where it's really at. And other activities, well, that's just kind of, you know, we have to do it, but sitting is really an important aspect of the practice. But actually, all our activities are equally important. And walking practice is a very integral part of mindfulness training as anything else is. If you ever go on a retreat, where 1-day retreat or 10-day retreat or whatever, you'll learn that the walking period and the sitting periods alternate back to back. And we'll walk just as much as we'll sit in meditation. We'll do sessions of walking meditation for 45 minutes or 40 minutes or half an hour or whatever, and then equal sessions of sitting meditation and equal lengths of time of walking meditation. And the walking is considered just as important as the sitting. Some people find the walking meditation is actually more delightful for their daily life than sitting meditation. And so their daily practice, rather than sitting for half an hour or 45 minutes every morning, they might do 45 minutes of walking meditation. And it actually seems to work nicer for them. They connect to it better and they're able to kind of settle and be more present in the walking. So also the walking meditation as a formal practice has the virtue that it's much closer to our normal life than sometimes what sitting is. We sit here kind of still and we close our eyes, and many of us have jobs that require a lot of sitting, but it's kind of a different kind of sitting. But we all kind of walk. Most of us walk around quite a bit and or get about, or there's different ways of walking. And we get about. We kind of move ourselves about, mobile, you know, driving and rolling and all kinds of ways of getting about. But it's all this comes to the same. So there's a formal way of doing it, but as we learn to do it in the formal way, as we kind of formally do the practice, then it kind of spills over into our regular activities also, because we walk around. I know some people who make it a practice to every day do walking meditation, where from the time that they get out of their car, if this is a circumstance, until they arrive at their desk at work. So every morning they drive to work, they get out of their car, and they do walking meditation, those 50 feet or 50 yards or however long it takes. Sometimes they might park for a little bit further away so they can have a little bit further to walk. And that becomes a time, a kind of sacred time for them every morning, where they actually do a mindfulness practice, where they're not going to kind of be busy thinking and preoccupied and rushing off, but in a dignified way, in a kind of slow, kind of maybe kind of present kind of way, be mindful of the process of walking, in the same way that when you're sitting here, you're mindful, aware of your breathing, what goes on within you. So the formal walking practice is relatively simple. As a formal practice, we choose a walkway, a pathway, that's about 30 or 40 feet long. And in some place where you're not going to be particularly disturbed, or you know, it's relatively easy to walk. And the practice is simply to walk back and forth those 30 or 40 feet. To keep the eyes open in this case, but kind of down about 45 degrees to the floor, not looking at anything particular. And keeping the hands in any kind of posture that seems comfortable. I often keep mine in my pockets when I do a walking meditation. And simply walk back and forth at a pace and in a way that brings you a kind of sense of ease as you walk. And most people can kind of find a sense of ease as they walk back and forth. Some people like to go for a walk when they're to cool down when they're angry. And you find some kind of ease kind of in yourself as you walk. So to find a pace that brings you a sense of ease as you walk. And often that's a little bit slower than maybe a normal walking pace. So and find just find that sense of ease in the walking back and forth. And then once that kind of basic sense of ease is found, it doesn't have to be dramatic, just a little bit of sense of ease, then sense the body, kind of the whole body. Like maybe like you imagine like you're a dancer and you're kind of moving through space like a dancer, feeling from the inside what it's like to be moving. And feel the body moving through space, and then allow the attention to softly settle down into the lower legs and the feet, because that's what's really where the movement is happening, is in your feet mostly. And just like in the sitting, we primarily pay attention to the breath, or say differently, the breath is kind of like the central point or the anchor that we keep coming back to. And so in the walking, the central point or the anchor is the feet and the lower legs as they walk. And there's a kind of rhythm to the walking, just like there's a rhythm to the breath. There's one foot goes up and moves forward and comes down, and then the next one, and then the next one. And simply to feel the sensations of that rhythm, and to be there, and the mind wanders away, and then very simply come back and feel the sensations, feel the rhythm. And if you're walking somewhat fast, you know, then maybe mostly what you're aware of is the contact of your sole against the ground, and you feel the pressure and the weight. And just feel that, you know, alternately, just feel it as it goes along. And that helps you keep in the present. You stay in the present, stay in the knowing by feeling the feet touching the ground. If you're walking slower, and sometimes we'll naturally kind of end up walking slower if we're doing walking meditation, because it's very nice to walk slow. Kind of you feel more intimate and calmer if you're walking slower. You might find yourself kind of naturally going slower and slower. Then maybe rather than just being aware of the soles of the feet touching the ground, you're aware of the various sensations that come up as the foot begins leaving the ground. The back foot kind of lifts up, and you feel a kind of lightening and maybe a tightening, a tensing of the muscles. And then you feel kind of the movement of the leg kind of swinging through space. And then you might feel the lowering sensations, the release, the relaxation, the lowering, and then the contact with the ground again, and then the pressure. And then you switch your attention to the back foot and you feel the same thing. And it's not like this thing to strive for. It's not that you're like really kind of grasping at these sensations. But it's in this kind of sense of whatever ease you can find. And it doesn't have to be much. You can actually feel quite stressed out when you start doing walking meditation. But if you can find just a hint of a little bit of ease, in that context, just kind of be with the ease as you do the walking. You kind of feel in that ease, feel the feet walking, come back to the walking. Sometimes discursive thoughts get the upper hand. And if you find yourself really lost in your thoughts, then sometimes it's useful just to stop in the middle of your walking period. Just stop in the middle of your track and maybe even close your eyes and just take stock and just do a little kind of mindful standing meditation, standing mindfulness, and just be aware of what's going on. Kind of do mindfulness of thoughts and feelings and emotions, and kind of, and once it's acknowledged and maybe processed some, then you can kind of continue with the walking. And it's lovely to learn a different how about how to walk. Many of us kind of walk at this point kind of automatically. We don't give it much thought, or we don't give it much knowing. But to kind of learn and get a sense and appreciation that it's really delightful just to walk for walking's sake, not try to get somewhere. I know in myself, when I'm trying to get somewhere, there are times when I'm kind of subtly, my grasping or my leaning forward, I'm kind of leaning slightly forward into the future or forward into the path. Like I'm trying to get something. My thoughts are kind of ahead of myself, and my center of gravity is slightly projected forward. But when I walk just for walking's sake, not to get anywhere particularly, then I'm more subtle in myself. My center of gravity is kind of going through my spine, kind of a more subtle, not leaning forward in a subtle way. And we can learn that in walking meditation, appreciate it. And then we can appreciate that that's actually possible even when we're walking, we have to get somewhere. You can actually need to get somewhere and not be ahead of yourself, and actually just kind of walk for, you know, you set yourself on that course and then you forget about it. And just kind of don't anticipate where you're getting, but just kind of walk in a way that you're walking in a mindful way. This is a passage by a wonderful, very sweet, simple Cambodian monk named Mahagosananda, who was living in Thailand during a genocide in Cambodia. And because he's one of the very few monks that survived, he now is the supreme patriarch of Cambodian Buddhism. But he's just a very simple kind of guy. I've met him. He's just really simple. The Buddha called the practice of mindfulness the only way, always in the present. At this very moment, from moment to moment, in all activity, in this very step. This is why we say, step by step, each step is a meditation. When the children in Providence, where he, I guess he lives for a while, when the children in Providence see me off at the station, as I walk up to the train, they shout, slowly, slowly, step by step, each step is a prayer. And all the passengers look and smile. This saying has become famous. The children do not know English well, but they know this sentence by heart. They are the new Cambodia, and already they know the way of peace. In Cambodia, we say, a journey of 10,000 miles begins with a single step. Slowly, slowly, step by step. Each step is a meditation. Each step is a prayer. So you might experiment a little bit as you go about walking in your normal life when you have to get somewhere, to see if you can shift the how you walk to still getting where you have to go, but shifting and just walking for walking's sake, not to get anywhere. And see if you can settle on yourself and just be present. Rest in the knowing of walking. And maybe with time you'll find a very deep satisfaction in just being simply alive without the need of always be ahead of ourselves, or always kind of lost or preoccupied with our thoughts. Another interesting exercise you might try at least once, maybe some of you do this, but anyway, but choose an hour somewhere or other, and around your neighborhood, walk for an hour for no purpose at all, no direction in particular, and just walk for walking's sake without any goal. For an hour. That's an interesting exercise, especially for those people who live compulsive lives, which is 80% of the people in Silicon Valley? 75? I don't know. Enough. Enough that it's a useful exercise. So that's a little bit about walking meditation. So now we'll do the other half of questions. Yes?
I listened to this tape by Joseph Goldstein, and he talks about the role of effort in practice. And he says there's this Pali word that that the Buddha used a whole lot. And he said the word was virya.
Virya.
Virya. And I wonder what you think of all that. I mean, what virya means and what it means for us in the practice. Sort of the role that it plays.
Oh, it's a very important role. There's a famous story of a man named Sunna. I think he was a monk, Sunna. But before he was a monk, he was a musician. He played the lute. And he came to the Buddha and he complained, said, I've been practicing meditation or practicing practice for a long time now, and nothing's happening. And so the Buddha kind of got a sense of the situation. And then he said, When you were a musician playing the lute, if the strings of the lute were too loose, would you make beautiful music? No, just kind of go clunk. And if the strings of your lute were too tight, would you make beautiful music? I said, no. But just when they're just balanced, when the tautness is just in a balanced way, then you make beautiful music, and then make nice notes. And the same thing with effort and practice. There has to be effort in practice, but the effort should be neither too tight nor too loose. It's a task of each person to discover for themselves what that balance is, and that balance varies from day to day a little bit, just the right amount. And and part of practice is to find what the right effort is. No one can really tell you what that is, but you're going to find your own way to find that midpoint. If there's not enough, and maybe a synonym for effort is engagement. Be engaged in what you're doing. To be engaged in the practice. You can stay at home and do a minimum amount of effort by just laying in the couch and staring at the ceiling, and you know, watching the television or whatever. Even that takes some effort. Everything takes some effort, but you know, that's kind of minimal, right? And you know, and you get duller and duller. Or you can kind of sit and try to sit upright and. Or walk and try to kind of bring yourself back. Make the effort to keep bringing yourself back when you wander off. Keep bringing yourself back. But bring yourself back without straining, without striving, without judgment, without criticism, without attacking or dismissing something or saying, oh, that was wrong, I wandered off. Don't be bothered by it, but just come back, to wake up, to keep coming back and waking up. And once we wake up and once we're present, to try to maintain that. But again, not maintaining it by grasping at the present, or at mindfulness, kind of being kind of loose with it. And if you're loose with it, it kind of, sometimes you wander off, for sure. If you're really grasping it, maybe you won't wander off so much, but you get the headache. But if you're making too much effort, it messes up the practice. But if you don't make any effort, then there's no practice. So effort is very important, but it's a matter of finding that balance. Yes.
I think it makes sense, like you said, that certain times in practice, when there are great obstacles in the sitting practice, with the mind being overwhelmed with anxiety, worry, brooding, rumination, and the strength of concentration and mindfulness in the face of those energies is very, very small, that it might make sense to cut back considerably on one's practice, one's sitting practice, maybe even sit for short periods of 15 or 20 minutes, and engage in more walking meditations or meditations while doing tasks. If the degree of concentration and mindfulness is a bit higher in those situations, rather than cultivate the habit of, in a sense, being caught up in thought.
I see. So what you're saying that if we're lost in a plethora of thinking and just we keep coming back and it doesn't seem to help and we just find ourselves kind of digging the ruts of thinking more and more,
right.
And we're very restless or very preoccupied or something, and that sitting maybe is not so useful then because we've sat, we tried our best, but it just seems like we're just kind of spinning ourselves more and more.
Developing bad habits.
That maybe some alternative, and one alternative that you suggested is sit shorter. And sometimes by sitting shorter, you can sit for 5 minutes. But by sitting that short of time, sometimes there's a way in which you add a better quality of attentiveness and ease because you know you only have these 5 minutes. So I'm really going to sit here in a calm way, in a present way. But if you sit for 40 minutes, then it just somehow because of the length of time, the mind kind of comes in. That's one way. Another way is not to sit at all. Sometimes it's not appropriate to sit if it's just too much restlessness and too much strong emotions or whatever. And sometimes that's a wonderful time to do walking meditation. And sometimes it can be very fast walking meditation, actually kind of power walk back and forth. Because that walking and that power walking can somehow allow you to contain the energy so you can be present for it and be mindful of it without being overwhelmed or by it at the same time. Sometimes taking a nap. Sometimes, you know, taking a shower. There's lots of strategies, but it's very well put and very, very good point. Do you have more?
Thanks.
Do you have more to say?
I think that's the same. I mean, obviously there's a skillful means.
Yeah.
How one organizes your practice rather than mechanically. Or maybe at some point you just need to have a sense of what's right. And I suppose a teacher is helpful at that point because deluding myself.
Yes. That's a very good important point. That if we have too many options for how to practice, if we have all these skillful means, there's walking and there's sitting and there's standing meditation and there's walking fast and there's walking slow and there's taking a shower and there's this and that, all these things I can do, you know, then we can just kind of be constantly bouncing around because I feel a little bit uncomfortable now. It doesn't seem to be working. So let's try this and that, you know. And there's something to be said about, even you call it kind of mechanical, but I would to have a kind of commitment to really try to kind of, you sit for half an hour every morning, and this is where you're really going to do this, even when it gets difficult. And not at the first chance kind of try to find a different skillful means. Because part of what the mindfulness practice is it's an acceptance practice. And we want to learn to accept ourselves as we are, even when things are really difficult, even when we can't do the practice. It's more powerful to accept yourself being unsuccessful to practice than it is to be a good practitioner. Does that make sense? So if you're constantly getting up and walking out to find a different practice to do, so you can really do it, but you haven't learned to accept yourself in a kind of rough kind of position, you've lost an opportunity. And so I think actually kind of, so Marty said, you know, maybe checking in with someone, with a teacher or, you know, is sometimes useful if you find yourself wanting to vary the way you practice, just to check out with someone else. You can use your common sense too. And my teacher in Burma, he insisted that I never sit down to do sitting meditation unless I first did walking meditation. And there was a way in which the walking practice helped settle me, helped provide kind of concentration and subtleness and presence that then would help a lot with the sitting. And so for a long time after being in Burma, when I sat in the morning, I would not start with the sitting meditation, I would start with 10 minutes of walking meditation. And it was also often very nice in the early morning because it kind of also kind of got me going a little bit, kind of woke me up a little bit more. And then I would sit down and I'd kind of be a little bit more energized. Yes.
I also find how necessary it is to go back and forth, because I think my neighbor see me doing that might be. Can you go if you don't have any particular place in mind to go to? You just walk around the block, or
you can't. You
necessary to go back and forth.
Yeah, you can. Go and you can anything at all. It's okay. Because mindfulness can be done any kind of way. So given your circumstances, you can do as you see fit. One of the advantages of walking, very important advantage of walking back and forth, is it's simpler. And if you're kind of walking around the neighborhood, there is a part of your mind has to negotiate the path and step around this, you know, car pulling out of the driveway and this and that, and you know, and then you have to kind of make sure there's no dog poop there, and you know, to kind of find your way, and you kind of, part of your mind is kind of concerned about it. It's a very simple part of the mind, but there's some kind of constant concern. If you're walking back and forth in an environment that's a little bit protected, pretty soon you know the route. And so that part of the mind can actually be a little bit more at rest. And that can be very useful. And also, after a while, you kind of know that what's going on around you, you're less likely to be distracted by sights, activity around you. If you walk around the neighborhood, there's all these things that might actually pull you out of your simple presence to your body as you walk and into your thoughts and concerns about, well, look at that car. You know, they got bought a new car. Isn't that great? I didn't know my neighbors, you know. And off you go, right? So, but if your situation is such that your neighbors are going to be ready to call, you know, the doctor, if they see you walking any more back and forth like that, then maybe it's wise, you know, to walk around the block. Or you can tell your neighbors, you know, I'm doing this is a, you know, a 2,500-year-old tradition of how to meditate. The last person to be enlightened in the lifetime of the Buddha was enlightened doing walking meditation. Yes?
You know, I had that experience where I live. I'm in a little mother-in-law cottage in the back. I'm doing walking meditation in the backyard, thinking this is very private. And the people in the front house were watching me. I'm really concerned. What is she doing? At first they thought I was mad. No, they didn't even, because I was wearing a jacket. Uh-huh. And realized it was me.
Yeah.
And so fortunately, someone in the front house recognized it was a form of meditation. It's so simple. Why should people react that way?
Well, slowly over the as meditation becomes more familiar to our culture, it'll be recognized more and more. Walking meditation is quite common. In Asia, there's a lot of it. And actually, you have in different places, especially in monasteries, you'll have particular parts of the monastery set out for walking paths, and they have walking paths, you know, specifically for that. So with time, we'll have that here too. But it's a concern. Like we're now kind of in the initial stages of trying to raise the money to have our own center here in Palo, in this area, so we can have our own meditation center. And it would be nice, one of our concerns is to be able to find a place where we could do walking meditation where it's a little bit of private, so that, you know, we're not doing walking meditation, you know, out there on Middlefield, you know, and all the cars driving by and see who. Because kind of, if you don't know what's going on, it kind of looks like, you know, all these zombies. So it is a concern where you walk. What else? Yes?
It's probably not something you could incorporate daily, but there is an interesting place for walking meditation at Grace Cathedral.
Oh,
the Labyrinth.
Nice.
And it gives you something to focus on, certainly.
Nice. And I found that, you know, there's often new opportunities for doing walking meditation. If I'm waiting for something, like waiting for the bus or the plane, or waiting for someone to show up, rather than sitting there kind of tapping my foot and you know, or pulling out my hair or whatever I might do, I'll just do walking meditation, just back and forth, and I don't really care too much what people think. So walking back and forth. Most people, you know, it's pacing, you know. The guy's pacing, he's nervous. You know, I wish he wasn't so nervous, but he's pacing. And so I often will, you know, if there's opportunity, I often just do walking meditation. And there was a time with our new baby that the baby seemed to do better, or we did better, if we walked the baby. And so I would put the baby in the carrier, front carrier, and go outside and just do walking meditation back and forth. And the baby loved it, just fell asleep. Marty?
Walking in nature allows for mindfulness of the foot and leg movements, as well as seeing, hearing.
Yes. So I distinguished earlier between formal walking practice, the formal meditation practice, and then just you doing walking, mindful walking just in all kinds of situations. And there's a lot of value to doing very formally, where it's so much simple and you're just kind of doing walking and there's not a lot of different sights and to pull you out and into your thoughts and all that. And it's also very valuable to kind of do it in all kinds of settings. Do it in nature, do it at work, do it on the way to work, do it waiting for the bus, you know. But nature is quite nice, and I like doing it in nature. When I do it in nature, then it becomes more for me a little bit more, sometimes a choiceless awareness meditation rather than a walking meditation. And the difference being, when with walking meditation, I'm really trying to stay present for what it's like for my body to be walking. Choiceless awareness is where I open the awareness up and I try to be aware of whatever arises predominantly in my awareness at any given moment. So I might be for a moment with a few moments with the feet walking, and then I hear a bird song, and I'm just there with the bird song. And then I see kind of the dapple of light through the trees, and I kind of look and see that for a while. And the mind kind of leisurely kind of goes and kind of is a presence for whatever is at that moment strongest experience. And so nature is a great way. It's very calming, can be.
Buddha. Did they not practice in nature, essentially, rather than meditation halls and things like that?
Quite a bit. There's a very strong forest tradition in Buddhism, doing all the practice in the forest and out in nature, but same thing. It's just two ways of doing it. There, you can do it as a formal walking practice. You don't pay attention to what's going on around you, or you can do it more choicelessly and pay attention to things. When I met this Mahagusananda, I had breakfast with him one day some years ago, and he was talking about how he was on his way to England, where he was receiving some kind of grant or prize or something from the British royal family for reforestation of Cambodia. And so I asked him, somewhat just to see his answer, I asked him, well, you know, what are you? You're a Buddhist monk, and you're responsible now for rebuilding Buddhism in Cambodia, and you must have a lot of busy work to do. And why are you interested in reforestation? he said basically what Marty said, that he said this: the Buddha was born under a tree in the forest, outside in nature in the forest. He was enlightened under a tree, he practiced and taught under a tree, and he died under a tree. And it's a central part of Buddhism, is to have trees and have nature and place to go and practice. So, yes?
Kind of interesting that you distinguish between choice of awareness and then meditating as you are. Because I actually find that I focus more often and sometimes better, most of the time better, by choice of awareness. Because that's how I originally learned.
Uh-huh.
I taught myself, I guess, before I knew what I was doing.
Yeah, it's a great practice. It's in a sense, it's the purest form of Vipassana practice, or it's the maturest form. When Vipassana or mindfulness practice becomes most mature, it becomes a kind of choiceless awareness exercise. But what most people find is that if they open up that choiceless kind of place too soon, there's no stability, and the mind just gets lost all the time, just stays lost. And so we use the breath as an anchor.
And I have a tough time anchoring myself with my breath. And exactly what you're talking about happens to me, and I really do have to work at it sometimes.
And so some people...
I find myself doing it, I know I shouldn't be, but...
So it can be work, and it can take a while to kind of get the hang of it, which might be the case. And sometimes it can be kind of initial kind of difficulty as we're kind of learning a new skill. It could also be that there's a better anchor for you than the breath. And if you like choiceless awareness, an alternative anchor, kind of default, where you keep coming back to when you get lost, is to listening. To sounds.
That's exactly what I tune into.
And so that's, again, you're selecting something to be the anchor. And listening is a great one. But choiceless would be you open to the whole thing. Tastes and smells and sensations in the body and thoughts and just the whole, whatever it might be. And So that's a great thing to do. You don't have to do the breath as the anchor. You can use sounds.
I was sitting here meditating, thinking how much nicer it is to sit here where there's a sound of the bird rather than where I live, where there's sounds of my neighborhood. And I started thinking, well, isn't that showing a preference, being partial? I mean, shouldn't I be just as happy meditating in nature as I am in the city?
Yes. And we have to be realistic and pragmatic. And if there's a preference that helps you to become more present, more compassionate, more in your life, then go with that preference for a while until your practice gets strong enough you can let go of that preference. But don't necessarily let go of that preference while that preference can still help you. But sooner, at some point, the practice, you're able to sit and find your presence without any kind of conditions. A useful way of being during meditation time is to be receptive. Receptive to whatever your breath is, receptive to whatever is happening inside of you, receptive to the sounds around you. Allowing all things to be as they are, as if they're kind of just passing through, but you're present receptively for them as they do. So if nothing else, I hope that today's talk inspires you a little bit to enjoy your walking more than you have. So thank you all.